This episode of The Telegram is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. And as a Telegram podcast listener, you will receive 10% off your first purchase by using the offer code Telegraph. Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. Power corrupts, and it has corrupted Vladimir Putin absolutely. As the crisis in Ukraine continues, we examine the character behind the man responsible. A professor of psychology tells us that Putin suffers from a debilitating need for power, and the Telegraph's experts on defense and Westminster tell us what the West can do to control him. All of which raises the question, is Britain really part of that effort, or have we cut and run from our international responsibilities? I'm joined in the studio by The Telegraph's Benedict Brogan and Con Coughlin, and down the phone by Professor Ian H. Robertson. We all know that power eventually corrodes a leader's reason. From Caligula turning Rome into a giant brothel to Idi Amin declaring himself King of Scotland, it detaches men from reality and threatens the liberty of the rest of us. But how exactly does this happen, and what do we do about it when it does? In the first part of this podcast, we're going to talk about the phenomenon of power madness. Ian H. Robertson, a professor of psychology at Trinity College Dublin and author of The Winner Effect, How Power Affects Your Brain, says this really does exist, and that Putin shows the sign of having power madness. I spoke with him earlier and began by asking him to define what the psychologist David McClelland calls the need for power.
The need for power is one of three fundamental, largely unconscious motivations that people have to different degrees. The other two are the need for affiliation, that is wanting to be liked and approved of by other people. The other is for achievement, that is to achieve significant goals in the world and to have a legacy, if you like, if you're a politician. And the third one is the drive to control what other people want, need, or fear. And these are, to a considerable extent, independent, and people have them to a certain degree. Any leader, particularly a world leader, needs to have a certain need for power. Otherwise, they become too stressed by the demands of leadership, because power effects on the brain include that of being an antidepressant and an anti-anxiety drug.
Right. So could you be a leader who doesn't have the need for power and therefore is a bad leader?
Absolutely. And I'm sure many people can think of bosses they have had in the past who have been bad bosses because they're insufficiently assertive or insufficiently desirous of imposing themselves possibly in a benign way, but really taking control of an organization. We need leadership requires that people have a certain appetite for power and enjoy power to some extent, because if they don't, they have a tendency to become very stressed or to lock themselves away or to end up being indecisive.
So we mustn't necessarily think of this desire for power as a bad thing. It can actually be a quality that is very helpful in politics.
Well, my view is that the evolution of the human species, which was that of a group, our survival and success has been because we've collaborated as groups, and groups require leaders. And so there's been an evolutionary pressure to develop people who have an appetite to be leaders and to engage in the kind of dominance behaviors that are required of leaders. But what happened, I am hypothesizing over evolution, is quite often you found that leaders started to show strange behaviors because of that power, sometimes made bad decisions, sometimes became cruel and narcissistic in their behavior. And my view would be that democracy, the artifacts of democracy, were developed, evolved as part of civilization to curb these effects on leaders. And that includes free press, independent judiciary, elections. These were clever inventions of human civilization to curb the biological effects of power on leaders.
Right. So in our raw natural state, if we hadn't developed these institutions, we would be inclined to not only be governed by strong people, but also to sort of allow that to happen. That's within our nature to expect people to want to dominate us.
Yes, to different degrees in different cultures. That there are maybe some primitive tribes where that is where the hierarchies are less steep or less strong. So there are different manifestations of this, but generally speaking, in almost all mammals, human and infrahuman, you have this tendency to form dominance hierarchies or status hierarchies, and that has profound effects. The nature of these hierarchies actually has profound effects on the biology and the brains of the people or the animals, depending on where they stand on that hierarchy.
Okay, so in the modern politician, if there's someone who is getting by on the thrill of power, there's someone who needs it, there's someone, therefore, who is constantly enveloped by it, there must come a point where that's actually psychologically unhealthy for them.
Yes, and I'm not saying there are no politicians who don't end up who avoid falling into that trap. So someone like Franklin D. Roosevelt seems to have been someone who could. He had three terms in office, and he didn't. He seemed to be able to maintain reasonable judgment and reasonable emotional balance. He didn't seem to succumb to the effects of considerable power. Whereas others, even who had shorter periods in power, seem to have done. And I just point here to the work of Lord David Owen, the former UK Foreign Secretary, who has written a book and published an article about the hubris syndrome, which would be his account of which world leaders he feels meet the symptom list for people who have succumbed to this, the pathological, the negative effects of extreme power.
And do you think that has happened in the case of Vladimir Putin, who's now been in charge in Russia for, what, I'm going to say 15 or 16 years?
Yes, I mean, either as prime minister or president. So I do think that he really does qualify for having some of the symptoms of the hubris syndrome. One of the key features he shows would be contempt for people in his cabinet, but also contempt for other world leaders. He seems to be very dismissive of even of Barack Obama and David Cameron. He seems to have and contempt would be one of the features of the hubris syndrome, because what happens when you're in power, you hold extreme power for a long time, you start to develop a very narcissistic view of the world and a very egocentric view of the world, and you also believe yourself to be, the risk is you believe yourself to be infallible. You develop an excessive confidence in your own judgment. If I can just say as a side line here, I spoke a few years ago to a very senior advisor to Tony Blair at the time when Tony Blair was still in power, and he was very defensive of Tony Blair, whom I was very critical of, and he wouldn't accept what I was saying about him, except at one point his brow furrowed and he said, well, yeah, what concerns me is his certainty, his sense of certainty. He was always certain. Now, that was something that developed very much, because the hubris syndrome would be a personality change that's caused by the power, not necessarily something that's pre-existing. Although in Vladimir Putin's case, the Soviet Union and Russia have a traditionally very, very steep power hierarchy and a very high acceptance that people in power can exercise it capriciously. And there's even a kind of valuing of people behaving in Tsar-like ways. So there's a cultural fostering of that kind of behavior. And so he probably had that propensity and that orientation already. But it's, in my view, his contempt for people, many people, Angela Merkel, apparently many years ago at a meeting, she upbraided him about the contempt with which he spoke about his own cabinet. But in fact, Tony Blair and his senior aides like Jonathan Powell They also, if you read their text, they were also quite contemptuous of their cabinet, you know.
But Tony Blair did eventually go. I mean, in the case of Russia, there's a valuing of power and abusing power, but there's also a valuing of longevity. The Soviet Union became a gerontocracy towards the end. People like Brezhnev running the country into their 80s. So although Tony Blair may have had those sorts of tendencies, he did step down. I mean, Margaret Thatcher eventually stepped down. They, of course, were pushed. But in Putin, there's a sense of a belief that without him, Russia would be nothing, that he has become the country, and that without Putin, there is no Russia.
Absolutely. So two things there. The only constraints that really are one of the two main constraints on these biological effects of power on the brain are external governance constraints, like your MPs chiseling you out of office, which happened to both Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. They didn't step down. It was huge pressure. Their own MPs got rid of them. But one of the other features of the hubris syndrome, one of the other features of the effects of power in the brain is there is the narcissism and the belief that you're indispensable, but there's also the parts of the brain responsible for self-awareness and self-criticism, they actually get down-regulated biologically by the effects of power.
Right.
So your capacity to be even aware of your own limitations or errors becomes diminished. And there is, of course, the Louis XIV, I think it was, of France, après moi le déluge. That is and de Gaulle showed in France showed that as well. The longer you are in office, the more you genuinely believe that everything will fall apart if you leave. And that means there's even a kind of you might even be deluded into thinking there's a moral argument for why you should continue to do all sorts of things to stay in office because your country needs you and your country will fall apart without you.
In the rest of this program, we're going to be discussing how you deal with people who are power mad. It might be helpful if you could close with a thought about that. How does one stand up to this kind of a person with this kind of psychological profile?
It's exceptionally difficult because the people below him are fearful of giving the feedback because such is the power that very likely they will suffer for trying to constrain it. So it has to come from either higher levels or sideways levels. So consequences and constraints are really the only way. With Hitler, for instance, he wanted to have a scorched earth policy in Germany and destroy everything because he felt the German people did not deserve to live, having failed him so much. And it was only Albert Speer refused to carry out his orders to destroy the country. So with someone like Vladimir Putin, the only way would be external constraints in the forms of sanctions of various kinds, not necessarily economic sanctions, but the kind of thing like the G8, maybe not taking place, or at least the preparations not taking place, because he is one of the other features of power is an extreme egotism, narcissism, and so there's a great need to feed off the admiration and to believe that you are admired and feared by the rest of the world. So practical constraints and the absence of proper governance constraints. We have a weak free press in Russia, we have a weak judiciary, and we have elections that, maybe don't meet those of Western standards. And so the internal Russian constraints in him are poor, and which allows his power to dominate and develop as much as it has. And so it has to be international constraints of some kind to try and temper this.
Ian Robinson, thank you very much. This episode of The Telegram is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, easy-to-use drag-and-drop tools, as well as a 100-strong Dublin, New York, and Oregon-based customer support team, on hand 24/7. And as a Telegram podcast listener, you'll receive 10% off your first purchase by using the offer code Telegraph. That was Professor Ian Robertson, leading us nicely into our next question. If we do accept that Vladimir Putin is power-hungry, how do we deal with him? To discuss this, I'm now joined by Benedict Brogan and Con Coughlin. Con, Professor Robertson says that we can't rely on internal factors to bring Putin down, and the only thing that he'll understand in the long term is external force. Do you agree with this analysis?
Well, I think I do. I think one of the really interesting things about this recent crisis is that we've really seen what Putin's like. And I was particularly taken by the press conference he gave earlier this week to a select group of Russian journalists, where he told a barefaced lie without even blinking. He said categorically there are no Russian troops in the Crimea. And every journalist, including the Daily Telegraph journalists who are in the Crimea, have confirmed there's a very significant Russian force that's been flown in to the Crimea. So we are dealing with somebody who's an habitual liar, which I suppose, given his background in the KGB, is something that you would expect of somebody with his training. But it does certainly affect the way we respond to him, because you're not dealing with a normal world leader who plays by the rules. You are playing with somebody who will try to get his own way at all costs. And the only way to stop that from happening is to apply quite significant pressure to bring him to heel.
Right, so we have to play as tough as he's playing, in other words.
If not tougher.
Benedict Brogan, are we in a position to do that?
We're certainly not. Militarily, we're nowhere, and we certainly can't contemplate any kind of military challenge that some people imagine that sort of thinks back to the days of the Cold War. But we do have other ways of confronting Vladimir Putin and Moscow. Those are largely economic. The fact is that Russia's banks rely hugely on the international capital markets to keep afloat. They are very shaky. Russian businesses and investors rely enormously on their ability to make full use of, for example, the city of London to access international capital. There are all kinds of ways in which, if the British government and certainly the European Union and the international community more widely could challenge Moscow economically and hit them where it hurts, I think the premise of the question is what troubles me slightly, in the sense that while it is certainly the case that people want to address the issue of Russian involvement in Crimea, it is not at all clear, it does not follow in my book, that the West and the international community want to get rid of Vladimir Putin. I think we should recall that Vladimir Putin is in place in part with the tacit agreement of the international powers, which were very grateful to see a strong man emerge from the chaos that the former Soviet Union descended into in the 1990s. And they look at this vast country with all its problems, and I think secretly quite like the fact that there's somebody there who has a firm grip on power, however unpalatable he may be.
So in a way, we've tolerated Russia's slide towards dictatorship.
Hugely, and I think we should also recognize that in the days post the 9/11 attacks on the United States, in the West, suddenly Vladimir Putin became a great friend, because here was somebody who signed up enthusiastically to the idea that there was an Islamist threat to civilization, as he would put it. And he was certainly in the forefront of robust, if not outright brutal, repression of such threats. And the West, and particularly the United States, were privately quite pleased of it.
Con, do you think when dealing with Putin, though, if he is, as you describe him, someone who does not play by the normal rules of international diplomacy, if he's not someone who particularly cares about his global reputation, do things like excluding him from the G8, are they really going to have any kind of effect?
Yes, I do. I think part of the whole psyche is that he loves being part of these international shindigs. It basically means that he and Russia are being taken seriously. And to be placed on the naughty step would be quite a significant reverse for Mr. Putin. And I think, actually, if you look at the way that this week has developed, the moment the Americans in particular, as Ben said, we're sort of slightly irrelevant in this issue, but the moment the Americans started talking about sanctions, about exclusion, you suddenly found Putin saying, oh, well, perhaps we can put the troops back to barracks and we can scale down the exercises on the Ukrainian border. And he pulled back. So it's working. But I think we can go further. And I think we should really take very seriously this threat to exclude him from G8, because even if he does pull back now, the point is he has violated the sovereignty of a country, and he should be punished for that.
Ben?
Well, I think Con's absolutely right that the threat of economic action and international action against Vladimir Putin always has an effect. I think what has been most troubling in recent days has been that while the United States has shown itself willing to talk about and contemplate such action, you have seen across the European Union a striking degree of what looks like timidity and cowardice in the face of Moscow. The Germans, who have huge economic involvement with Russia, have been very hesitant to go down that path. Britain, which has been pursuing a foreign policy under this government of putting huge investment into a number of important bilateral relationships, whether it's with China or now with Moscow, has started talking about sanctions. But we got a hint earlier in the week that the government is very wary about putting any threat, any undermining in any way Russia's involvement in the City of London, Russian involvement in Britain,
and money laundering.
And well, you know, they wouldn't recognise those words, but certainly the British government recognises Russian financial involvement in London. And it has been striking that even though the powers are there and they are seen to be effective, Europe has been surprisingly deficient in terms of its willingness to deploy that power.
It always is, though, isn't it? I mean, it was the case during the breakup of Yugoslavia that Europe talked a certain game about civilization and democracy and human rights, but actually it was really America that mattered when it came to dealing with that crisis.
Yes, had it not been Richard Holbrooke, they'd probably still be fighting. I think the problem with the EU, which you know this newspaper's said repeatedly, is the larger it gets, the less it works. And you'll see that with this emergency meeting of the EU foreign ministers. 28 states, 28 different agendas. And there is quite a serious rift now between those within Europe. And I would count Britain amongst them, that want to confront Putin, to stand up to him in whatever ways we can. And I think our room for action is limited. But even so, that's the position they want to take. But a lot of European countries just don't want to get involved in a fight with Putin. And which means that nothing will happen. And you've also got this bizarre situation with NATO, which is, you know, represents more European countries than anything else. Where they just don't want even to draw up any plans for military action against the Russians. I mean, it's quite bizarre where we are on this crisis.
Both of you have written about how the crisis exposes the weakness of Britain and its sort of impotence on the world stage and how increasingly unimportant it is. Ben, is it that this particular crisis is simply too complicated for Britain to take a firm line on, or does it really reflect a longer trend? Is it similar to Syria? Is it part of a post-Iraq withdrawal from the world?
You can look at it in two ways. You can say that the government, in fact, is being quite honest about the limitations of Britain's power in the second decade of the 21st century. It recognises that where Britain has influence, it should deploy it. But at the same time, it also realises that we are economically bust. We are still rebuilding. We do not have the military resources that allow us to contemplate any kind of foreign engagement, particularly something as massive as any kind of involvement in the Crimea would imply. But what is telling, though, is there's a slight degree of political hesitation about using the power we do have. Britain does have power by dint of being London at the moment is the capital of the world. It is the place where all those oligarchs and all international wealth wants to come, wants to invest, wants to be. And that gives us a really useful lever against Moscow and against other countries that deploy these kind of bully boy tactics. But of course, because we are also adopting a posture of pleading for investment in Britain in order to get growth going and the economy going, whether it's China or Russia or India, our posture has been one of the supplicant who is terrified of frightening off possible cash investment in the UK economy. And that, I think, leads to a certain timidity in our foreign policy.
It can also lead, surely, to moral compromise. If we're desperate to draw cash in from countries that are fundamentally dictatorships.
True, but I think you're always in a dangerous area if you start sort of bringing morality into foreign policy. The fact is, all we have is interests, and what we should be looking to is our interests. And the question is, what is our interest in this case? And some people would say that the government has calculated that our interest is to reach an accommodation with Moscow and with Vladimir Putin, however awkward and complicated it may be.
Con, do you think the crisis has shown us that soft power is simply not as good as hard power when a real crisis emerges?
Well, that's a good point, Tim. I mean, in my view, DFID is not going to solve the crisis in Ukraine.
Yeah. Building lots and lots of wind farms all over Ukraine.
So I think this is a wake-up call, and it should be a wake-up call to the government. And as Ben says, we do have the means to provide leadership. Because one of the things I find rather worrying is the lack of leadership in the Western Alliance. And you look back 20 years ago to that period after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Britain was very much a leading voice in steering and directing policy, the invasion of Kuwait, get rid of Saddam Hussein and all that. Even in the Balkans, we were somebody that people wanted to listen to, and you just feel that's gone. And I do blame the Syria vote very much. I think there was an enormous erosion of the ability of the Prime Minister to lead not just the country but others, because he just didn't seem to have that natural authority that people respect.
But that was Parliament's will, and of course the Prime Minister's mistake to put it to Parliament.
It was a mistake to put it to Parliament, perhaps, but the point is he made such an awful argument in favour of action. It was ill-considered. Very few people in the British establishment, the military, actually supported what he was doing. And he found himself very isolated, and it made him look very weak, which is why there was this poll earlier this week by YouGov, a poll asking people who they thought was the strongest leaders of the current age. And the majority said it was Vladimir Putin, and David Cameron came bottom.
Yeah.
And I think that's his own fault.
But it actually may be, to David Cameron's credit, some might say, that unlike Tony Blair and possibly even Gordon Brown, it is not in his nature to rush in front of the cameras or to rush to Geneva or wherever talks are being held, to put himself in the front row for the group photograph of leaders getting themselves involved in whatever international crisis crops up. He has not taken that kind of activist role that Tony Blair certainly took. The problem with that is that he opens himself to the criticism which Con makes, and which I think is entirely justified, that for a front-rank country, which is one of the world's largest economies and still has pretensions of being a serious player in the world of NATO, in the United Nations, a permanent member of the Security Council, that Britain carries a certain responsibility to be in the forefront of these debates about global order. And the thing that I have been struck by on the Ukraine crisis is the way in which Britain appears to have been absent from much of the conversation,
yeah.
In that you get the impression that Angela Merkel is in there and Barack Obama is in there, and for goodness sake, even the French are in there. But yet Britain, you don't get the sense of urgency from David Cameron and from William Hague that they want to be leading the conversation and shaping the conversation.
Is there then a tension in modern British politics between, on the one hand, we want leaders who are cool and rational, and we're a democracy, so we don't want to be dictated to like the power-mad Vladimir Putin. On the other hand, as this poll suggests, a part of us still admires and respects strength. So how do we find some way of bringing those two things together, of both being a listening democracy of leaders who don't rush into things, and on the other hand, somehow projecting a sense of leadership and of force?
Well, my view is that it is very difficult to project strength and leadership on the international stage if, on the basic measure of strength, we have abdicated our responsibilities, and that's in the military sphere. We have allowed our military capacity to be eroded to a point where we basically can't we couldn't fight a war if we wanted to. And the fact is that people know that, people can see that, people know that we are economically too poor to be able to pay for it, and that in the end, Vladimir Putin and all these people out there knows that if the chips are down, we're going to struggle to get to the party.
Con.
Yeah, I would add to that, it didn't have to be like this. I mean, the government keeps saying, you know, we're bust and we don't have the money for a strong military. Well, as I keep saying, then why give all this money to DFID?
Yeah.
I mean, we could just as easily have strengthened or maintained the strength of our armed forces rather than give money to the Ministry of Blank Checks, as I call it.
But or spend the money on tax credits or pensions or the NHS. You know, yeah. It's not just DFID. I think there are huge areas of government spending which...
But it plays into the soft power, hard power argument. But I also think that my other point about, you know, why is Britain in this mess is I think we don't the current generation of political leaders do not have a strategic vision. Now you look at Margaret Thatcher and you look at Tony Blair, love him or hate him, but they actually had a vision of what they should be doing. I mean, Blair, particularly with the Chicago speech, you know, he believed in what he was doing, and because of that belief, it gave him the energy to get on the front foot and to steer the debates in the direction that he wanted it to take. And I feel with the current generation, it is all just knee-jerk reactions. They don't have a clear view of Britain's place in the world or how to. And having established what Britain's place in the world is, to then pursue that objective. And I think that is why they find themselves in this mess.
Con, just to close with, as you're a defence expert, could you give us a sense of what's happened to our military in the last 10, 20 years, since the end of the Cold War? How reduced is it? Because I think people talk about this, but they might not have a real sense of the numbers and of what it actually looks like.
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say that the British military has done a brilliant job in the past decade. I mean, whatever you think about Iraq or Afghanistan, the military per se have actually done an exceedingly good job. They get no credit for it. Mm. The really big problem we've got looking forward is because of the cuts, we will no longer be in a position to do the kind of enduring expeditionary operations we've done. And the assumption is there will never be another Iraq, there will never be another Afghanistan. From now on, it's drones and special forces and just having a very light footprint. A lot of ministers say to me, you know, Libya was a template, not a single British boot on the ground, not a single British casualty, mission accomplished. Well, you look at the mess of Libya today and the fact we did have boots on the ground, we had special forces guiding in the missiles and all the rest of it. This is a great delusion and it's going to come back to us sooner or later, and I believe it will be sooner, particularly when you see what's going on in places like Crimea. And the fallacy of this policy will be exposed.
Con Coughlan and Benedict Brogan, thank you both very much. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.